The show of support from you, our valued listeners, has been overwhelming. You've already raised enough to pay for most of this year's worth of episodes. If you can afford a little something, please click the link to the GoFundMe in the show description. Thank you so very much. Welcome to Let It Roll, the insanely ambitious musical history podcast hosted by Nate Wilcox. We've covered the early history of rock and roll, country music in the 20th century, the rise of hip-hop, disco, and electronic dance music, and heavy metal. Stay tuned for our histories of Broadway, opera, punk rock, jazz, blues, ragtime, Latin music, and gospel. Follow the Let It Roll podcast on Twitter, at Let It Rollcast, and check out our website at letitrollpodcast.com. Let It Roll is a Pantheon podcast, and you can listen to more great podcasts at www.pantheonpodcasts.com. Today, Nate welcomes back Brooks Long to discuss the autobiography of Betty LaVette, co-written by David Ritz. Email us at letitrollpodcast@gmail.com. Pop in those earbuds and enjoy.
It's time to Let It Roll. I'm your host, Nate Wilcox, and tonight we're joined again by Brooks Long, which means the David Ritz Book Club continues. Tonight, it's Betty LaVette, A Woman Like Me, her autobiography written with the help of the estimable Mr. David Ritz. Brooks, thanks so much for picking this one. I would not have picked this. And Betty is my jam. I really identify with Betty.
Yeah. I knew when we were looking through the David Ritz list that eventually we had to get to her. We've talked a lot about folks that had big success the way that we usually see them, 20 years old or something like that. And we've also talked about like Jerry Wexler and things like that. And we just talked about Rick James, who took about maybe a decade longer than you would have thought for him to really pop. But yep. Betty put in a little more time than that, probably about 3 decades long or maybe even longer to really get where she was going. But in the meantime, while she was getting there, there's just so much history that she moves through. And it's really interesting in that way. And it's also interesting to just see what, a regular working stiff musician's life is like as they're, trying to get somewhere for decades.
Yeah, it's rough. I mean, the basic who is Betty LaVette, because I didn't know until, I'd seen her name on the list and then I looked her up. But it wasn't until I realized that David Ritz had written a book about her that I looked her up. But, 5-6 years ago, I didn't even know who David Ritz was. So, here we are. But Betty LaVette was a woman born in Detroit in 1946, had a top 10 R&B hit on Atlantic Records when she was 16 years old, which didn't work out that well for her in the long run. Yeah. And she had a couple more minor R&B hits in the 60s, had multiple albums recorded in the 70s, late 60s, early 70s, right at that sweet spot, following in the wake of Aretha Franklin and Etta James and others. She's taping with the Memphis Flyers in Memphis. She's taping with the Swampers and Muscle Shoals, albums on multiple labels. Leland Rogers, Kenny Rogers Brothers label. It was his label. And then Atlantic, a whole album on Atlantic and never released. Then she had a disco hit, minor disco hit, but pretty legendary one. And then she had a long cold spell. Then in the 90s, she starts this comeback. And by the 2000s, she's singing at the Kennedy Center. She's winning or getting nominated for Grammys. She has a string of extremely well-regarded albums that performed quite well. She made a nice living on the touring circuit. So it's a happy ending, but a long way to get there. And Betty, it's also a tale of work and self-improvement and taking care of yourself. I mean, she knew David Ruffin before he was David Ruffin, and she watched him sadly pass. And she liked to party, and she drops the dirt. I mean, Betty doesn't care.
No, this is very similar to the Etta James biography, in that she's just going for it.
Yeah, and she's much more bitter than Etta James ever was. Yes. I mean, Etta was her own worst enemy. Betty was basically up against all of Motown.
Yeah, all of Motown, all these different producers and record label people who, you know, loved her singing voice as they should and promised her the world. And just when things seemed to be turning around, something would always happen and they just couldn't put it out. It happens over and over again in this book. And it's like, how did this woman keep it going? Well, she kept it going because she really knew who she was. She is a diva, just like all the other ones that we know about. And she knew it, and everybody who knew her knew it. She just needed the world to know her.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's two things that jumped out at me really early on. The first was the dedication to Jim Lewis, who she calls a star maker. Yeah. No idea who Jim Lewis was. So, you know, the book will tell you plenty about that, and we'll talk about that. But Jim Lewis is the guy who took her under his wing. And she's very open about the nature of her relationships with men. Yes. And they were frequently transactional. Frequently, she slept with men who she thought could advance her career. And she's totally upfront that was the norm at the time. That's just how the game was played. And she was playing the game, and she liked sleeping with men. So, you know, it worked out. Yeah. But except when it didn't. And the intro is one of these, it's like a TV movie of the week where they start with the most dramatic, crazy, violent scene. And it starts with her taking a beating from a pimp. She had fallen into the clutches of a pimp at a very young age in New York City. And he ends up, did he hang her out the window or just threaten to hang? He did hang her out the window.
He did. He did.
Yeah. I mean, you know, and she walked away from that with her head high. I mean, she got herself out of that situation and got free of that gorilla. And that's not a racial thing. That's a reference to a style of pimping. And yeah, the gorilla pimp who, you know, dominates with his fists. And she got away from that monster and just kept on going. So it's an inspiring tale. Thank you very much for picking it. Let's go ahead and hear our first song. This is a song that started it all for Betty. This is My Man is a Lovin' Man, 1962. Probably released early 63, actually. Was My Man is a Loving Man, which came out on Atlantic Records in late 62, early 63, goes, I believe, to number 7 R&B in 63. Great start, slinky song. I think if you listen to it in the context of what else was on the R&B charts that year, it's not retro or nothing. I mean, to me, it sounds like the hello card from somebody who's going places, and she just didn't. What's your take on that tune?
Oh man, well, there's so many things that I think about. I mean, she does not sound her age, which was 15.
Yeah.
And it is quite remarkable that she was one of these precocious kids, a lot like Esther Phillips was, little Esther at the time. And I think Gladys Knight was one of those kids. And you know, we've also talked about like Aretha, who also lived in Detroit, Aretha Franklin, who yep. also lived in Detroit Aretha. With her. Yeah, yeah. And they get to be friends. One thing that I think really strikes me is that Betty really, she is absolutely 100% a soul singer, and but is also really versatile, but she's got a real rock and roll grit, like a Tina Turner or a Betty Davis. Honestly, the person that I think of the most when I think of like her phrasing plus the gritty voice, I really think of Billie Holiday and Howlin' Wolf.
That's just combination.
Yeah.
I can see that.
She really had something, and she had it when she was 15 years old.
She did indeed. But this Jim Lewis cat ends up mentoring her and really instilled some values in her that enabled her to continue to grow artistically throughout this entire arduous period. I mean, most people give up long before this, but Betty kept working and growing and listening and widening her set of influences and also going deep on key influences. And by the time she finally got her break, she was in shape. She was in good voice, amazingly good voice for somebody who sings this all out.
Oh, yeah.
And she had developed as an artist such that she was able to do a string of really creative interpretive singer albums, which is hard to do. I mean, you got to find the material. And she ends up marrying a guy who basically becomes her A&R man. And you know, the kind of guy who goes through hundreds of songs to find 10 or 12 for an album. And she is a tough judge by the sound of it. But let's get into the first of it. I'm so glad that you steered me towards talking about the second half, because I got so into the minutia of this first half because she drops so many names. She worked with everybody. She toured with Clyde McFadder, Benny King, Barbara Lynn, Otis Redding. She knew all the Motown people. She was mixed up with a lot of the Motown people.
That's right.
What the man she thought was the love of her life was Clarence Paul, mm-hmm. who was Stevie Wonder's uncle. Now, was he his real uncle or not? I can't remember. But the important thing is he's the guy who, you know, kind of mentored Stevie early on, was his early songwriter. And according to Betty, Clarence Paul fell out with Berry Gordy when he went home with Berry's then ex-wife, Ray. And you know, she was a very important figure in Motown. And early on, and by the time Barry Gordy got home, they're both drunk and naked, although they claim nothing going on. But according to Clarence Paul per Betty LeVette, that was it. And she didn't realize that. She kept trying to use Clarence Paul as her in with Motown for years, and it didn't work. But first, we should talk about how it was that she puts out a top 10 R&B hit on Atlantic at 16, and then ends up not on Atlantic in a very short period of time. What was your take on that whole sequence?
Oh boy. Well, it sounds like the sort of thing that happened to people a lot, whether they continue moving up or not. That first brush with success is always a little shady, a little dark. And it seems like Johnny Mae Matthews, who I wasn't aware of before this, but apparently she was, they call her the godmother of Detroit soul. And yep. She was somebody who discovered all these people, including Otis Williams in the Distance, who's with the Temptations, David Ruffin, a lot of singers who would be associated with Detroit first got their start with Johnny Mae Matthews. And it sounds pretty rough. Their royalties were pretty much out of the question with Johnny Mae, and the threat of violence was there, but she had connections. She had a connection to to Jerry Wexler, and this is how these things often get started, you know?
Sorry to jump in, but I should introduce that Betty was not born Betty LeVette. She was born Betty Jo Haskins in Muskegon, Michigan in 1946, raised in Detroit. She met a singer named Ginger LeVette and literally asked her for the name on first meeting, the LeVette name, and got the green light, although I don't know that Ginger could have done anything to stop her. But Ginger introduces her to one of these guys, Timmy Shaw, who's one of these guys who's a wannabe player and also a wannabe pimp. And Betty's very clear that that was a very gray line, that both men and women in the music industry were pimping in this period in one way or in multiple senses of the term. You've got people like Ted White, who was Aretha Franklin's husband, we talked about, and also was a big time pimp. And Betty was friendly with Ted and Aretha and had a lot of insights to that, the nature of that relationship and other relationships, although her attitudes, you have to say, are pretty retrograde. I mean, she's one of these, she just straight up and says, sometimes these women needed to be hit.
Which, yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Betty definitely has, a point of view that is definitely informed, and you know there's part of me that backs away from that, and there's part of me that accepts that as her reality,
because and the reality of that era
and the reality of the era, yeah, because it's so prevalent. Etta James said it too. And Etta James even said, like, Berry Gordy was right there with him. He was that's what is said. I mean,
if you watch one of those recent Berry Gordy and Smokey documentaries, Smokey Robinson, where they're palling around together and just laughing and cackling about how many women they slept with and clearly use their power to do that. I mean, if you, especially Berry Gordy, if you look at him, you know, he's no taller than me. Well, let's hear our second song. This is Mickey Newberry's Just Dropped In to See What Condition My Condition Was In, most famously done by Kenny Rogers in the first edition. Here's what Betty did with that song.
Woke up this morning with the sun down shining in. Found my mind in a brown paper bag within. Tripped on a cloud, fell 8 miles high. Told my mind on a jagged sky. Hey, I dropped in to see what condition my condition was in. Pushed my soul in a deep drop hole and then I followed in. Watched myself falling out.
And that was Betty LeVette saying, just dropped in to see what condition my condition was in. And she did that for Leland Rogers' label. And that comes out, it's reissued by Sun, ends up that, Leland Rogers was financed by Shelby Singleton, who's the guy who bought Sun Records from Sam Phillips. So many of the connections from the show are coming together in this episode. And Shelby was riding high off the money from Tom T. Hall's Harper Valley PTA, which had been recorded by Jenny C. Riley and just become this immense number one. I mean, a number one pop hit so big they made a movie about it 10 years later. So, and yet, once again, you know, Leland and Betty cut a whole bunch of great tracks with Charlie Freeman and Jim Dickinson, the kind of Jerry Wexler's dream band that he put together and took to Miami. He stole and took to Miami.
Yes.
Betty was working with
a nice way of saying it, yeah.
Yeah. And I should mention that this is one book in which Jerry Wexler isn't the villain, or is he? Because we don't know. Oh, why Atlantic didn't put out her record. But we do know that after she had one hit on Atlantic and then recorded a follow-up that stiffed and then had some management difficulties, that she walked out on Atlantic because she wanted to be produced by Lieber and Stoller, who had left to go out on their own with Redbird Records, and she refused Burt Bacharach. So,
yeah, she sure did. Oh, I'm not sure if that pairing would have worked out anyway.
It's hard to imagine. It's really hard to imagine, but it could have been something special. But
to Jerry's credit, Jerry gave her some walking money.
$500, and that was a lot of money in the early '60s.
Yeah, yeah. That, course, you know, got to give it to...
It's probably her royalties anyway.
It might have been.
Actually, it's hard to say. I mean, R&B hit, the top 10 R&B hit at that point in time wasn't making a ton of money. And we should mention, you know, when she asked for royalties on that, that she got throat slammed by Johnny May.
Yeah.
You know, and told a no in certain terms not to do that. And then her management, she had partnered with Robert West, who I talked about extensively when I interviewed Tony Fletcher about Eddie Floyd. Robert West was Eddie Floyd's uncle, but he was also the guy who discovered him and Wilson Pickett and managed the Falcons and very, very much a record man, very much a player. And he ends up partnering with Herman Griffin, who, and I'm going to do a Mary Wells episode soonish, but Mary Wells was the big star of Motown 64. She leaves Motown because of this guy. Sounds like an idiot. I mean, if you read the stories about Herman Griffin, you know, trying to conduct the Funk Brothers band live on stage and nonsense like that. And anyway, Griffin and West partner. Griffin takes Mary Wells away from Motown, signs her to 21st Century Fox, partners up with Robert West, and it seems like this is going to be the Detroit combo that can really take on Berry Gordy. Problem was, those two got to drinking, got in a fight, and West ended up getting shot with his own gun, and never really recovers. So Betty takes a deep hit when that happens, and that's when she meets Jim Lewis, who's trying to tell her, hey, girl, I can help you, you know, listen to me. And she doesn't. And she moves to New York on her own. And that's when she ends up falling to the clutches of Jay the Pimp. And, you know, she has a good run, though. I mean, she has a top 20 R&B hit, I think, on Cala Records, produced by Don Gardner of Dee Dee and Don fame. And, you know, all through this, I mean, she recorded an unreleased single with Luther Dixon of Scepter Records. That's the guy who made the Shirelles, the record man behind the Shirelles. She meets Esther Phillips, who you mentioned earlier.
Yeah.
Who's all strung out. And that warns Betty off of the hard stuff. I found it fascinating the way Betty could party with the best of them, but pull back before she went over the abyss. I mean, she only took LSD once and recognized, oh, not for me. She stayed well away from heroin, and then she skips out on crack.
Well,
that's,
I mean, it's, one thing I notice is that Betty grew up in an environment. She wasn't one of these people like a Marvin Gaye, who grew up in an incredibly religious and incredibly not very worldly environment, and then goes into the secular
yeah, she
world.
Wasn't ever church. She was a vehement atheist.
Yeah, yeah.
With the whole from the get and stuck with it.
Yeah, and her parents were, you know, bootleggers who, you know, all the different entertainers and various kinds of people, seedy and not, seem to know them and come through the house and come through the neighborhood. So people like that, I'm from West Baltimore, so, you know, I haven't gotten into a lot of stuff either, but I've been around a lot of stuff. And I think if you grow up in a certain environment, you might be a little wiser than somebody who's just seeing this stuff for the first time.
That could well be, but we got a lot to cover because I want to cover the whole first arc of her career in the next 5 minutes. So, you know, the big heartbreaker, the album that broke her heart, was when she got this opportunity to return to Atlantic. And this is the post Aretha Franklin Atlantic. And this is the Led Zeppelin and Rolling Stones Atlantic. This is, you know, they're part of the Warner Brothers empire. They're huge. And this guy, Ollie McLaughlin, is one of many A&R guys who, you know, fight for her to varying degrees of success. He tried and failed to get her on Atlantic. Then he succeeded. They cut a whole album with the Muscle Shoals Swampers down in Muscle Shoals. Got Brad Shapiro, who was red hot at the time, producing it. She had this pianist that she met, Rudy Robinson, who stuck with her through thick and thin, that she, you know, swear he was one of the few killer musicians. I'm not few, but one of probably quite a few top-notch musicians who never got to work with the Funk Brothers in the Motown studio. I mean, there was plenty of talent on the keys, you know.
Earl Van Dyke and folks like that, and yeah.
Yeah, and so, you know, Rudy was surplus, and I don't even know if he applied. It seemed like Rudy was also a lush, but he, you know, he's playing on this. He does this incredible arrangement of Neil Young's Heart of Gold, that what would have been on that album, which is now released, and you can get it.
But great album.
Yeah, it's an incredible album, and she gets a single put out. She's got her plane tickets for the tour when she gets this call out of the blue: send us the tickets back, tour's canceled. Never found out why. And she had already gone crawling back to Detroit after the pimp experience in New York. And this Jim Lewis cat, you know, took her in and really educated her, or made her educate herself about all the great jazz singers. She was a little older, so he really knew the jazz stuff, and really had her pay attention and learn that craft, and really drilled it into her head. Keep listening, keep growing. And it absolutely worked. Then she got on a deal with Epic Records, produced by Ron Dunbar. She records killer version of Behind Closed Doors, the Charlie Rich hit, and dropped again. Then she has a brief disco hit. She's on West End Records for like 15 minutes. Corey Robbins, who, you know, pretty legendary disco producer, was only 19 at the time. He cuts Doing the Best That I Can on her. Actually, he already had it cut. All she had to do was come in and drop the vocals in. Walter Gibbons, the legendary, you know, pioneer of the 12-inch remix, did a remix on it that is one of the disco classics. This ties in so much with our Techno Roll series, but yeah. She quits West End Records because she thought she was going to get a deal with Steve Buckingham and Arnie Geller, who were, you know, hot off I Love the Nightlife by Lisa Bridges. Her songs never come out. Then she does this weird 6-year run on Broadway with Bubbly and Brown Sugar. She's working with Cab Calloway. So that's pretty, you know, again, quite an item for your resume. Then she finally gets on Motown in 1980 with and puts out the Tell Me a Lie album. But Stephanie's telling me time for a sponsor break. When we come back, we'll talk about how Betty rose from the ashes and triumphed.
Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here, taking a break from listening to a little Shout It Out Loudcast episode. Love Tom and Zeus talking all things Kiss. Of course, I was listening to them on my new Raycon wireless earbuds. They have quickly become my go-to earbuds because of the comfort. These soft tips are the best I've ever used. And at this price, plus a Pantheon discount, Raycon is really hitting on all marks. Sound quality is great too. I really love having these three EQ options because I like more bass in the music, but less in my podcast. 8 hours of playtime for the battery is great as well. Surround sound, noise isolating, and awareness mode are all included. These are great earbuds. Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order plus free shipping. That's right, you'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon. Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here. Another day, another podcast I'm working on. This time, it's Famous and Gravy with Amit and Michael. I want to let you know that I loved the Factor Meals package so much that I re-upped for myself, and then I sent a package to my in-laws. Like I was with my first shipment from Factor Meals, the in-laws were as excited to try one of the prepared restaurant-quality meals. Well, they got the shipment of Protein Plus Meal Plan and were very impressed. See, being in their 80s, anything to make the meal prep easy is a plus for them. They heated the oven per instructions and minutes later were enjoying a very delicious, nutritious, and dietitian-approved meal. One big win for me. But what really floored them was the taste. Like I told you, it's surprising how good these meals taste. Restaurant quality indeed. And like my own shipment, it really was everything Factor Meals said it would be for some seniors. No prep, no mess meals. Factor Meals are 100% ready to heat and eat. Take it from me and my in-laws. Head to factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. That's factormeals.com/Pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. Thank you, Factor Meals.
So after all that hard work, all those tours, all that recording, all that working with, I mean, the best musicians in the business, the best producers in the business, and she's touring with the best acts in the business and more than holding her own, and nothing comes of it for her. So by the late 80s, she's playing piano bar gigs with her faithful man, Rudy, on piano. She's playing a club on the Wayne Street campus called the Library. And then, you know, as at the absolute ebb of her fortunes, when she meets another man, Robert Hodge, who's just like a dude who'd made a lot of money in tech, or not a lot of money, but, you know, made a nice living in tech. Maybe he was rich. I don't know. She doesn't really say. She just describes him as tech. He's got enough money, though, to become her manager. And she calls him the man who basically got me through the 90s. And once again, it's a sexual love relationship with strings attached, but. You know, they stayed friends to the end, even when she left him for a producer at the first opportunity and then married another man. But, you know, she kind of had this mentor figure who was sort of a party girl and that was going to deflower Stevie Wonder, but didn't show up. But
right.
That woman gets two whole chapters, I think. But yeah, what was your take on that? And that, her name was Mary Early, and she was apparently
Mary Early.
Yeah, Mary Early, and often
for sure. I think it is so fascinating, just like the approach to sexual behavior among these Detroit folks. I mean, you know, it shouldn't be that shocking, but just it's just so casually transactional that it makes you really reconfigure everything you sort of thought. And I just keep going back to Motown and and you know, women that might have been in precarious situations there,
or who used it to get all the way to the top, like Diana Ross, who was obviously very, very talented but had Barry Gordy's baby.
Yeah, for sure. But Mary Early seems to be like someone who was not too much of a performer, more of like a fashion person, things like that. Is that right?
And yeah, I mean, model, groupie, scene maker. She's one of these beautiful women who was so cool and socially powerful that she just moved, you know, through these scenes at a pretty high level. And, you know, this was the free love era, and Mary Early was, you know, way out in front and inspired Betty LeVette. But we should get back to our story because there's a lot to it. And you know, one of these another phenomenon that ties in with the techno role series I did with Ryan Hartness, and hopefully we'll continue at some point when Ryan's gets freed up again, but is this phenomenon of Northern Soul, which is this totally bizarre phenomenon where British fans, you know, the mods basically in Northern England who didn't want to get into psychedelia or soft rock or hard rock, they wanted to stick with the Motown and the Stax that they loved. And they did that. And they made it, instead of having disco all through the 70s, they had this massive dance club scene all over the north of England, obsessed with obscure American R&B 45s from the 60s, mostly from the north. They call it Northern Soul in part because they were in the north of England, Manchester, Leeds, etc., but also because they were fascinated with Detroit soul, Chicago soul, New York soul, DC. I mean, and they weren't against Memphis or New Orleans or whatever, but they really loved that stuff that was, and some of their biggest ones were on Motown, but kind of Motown adjacent would be, mm-hmm. Betty describes it as, they love the funkier side of Motown, the more obscure, the better. Since no one was more obscure than I was, which isn't true, but I can see why she would say that. I became a Northern Soul sweetheart. And so this becomes a massive scene. And this ends up playing a big role in the Acid House explosion. A ton of people who grew up in the Northern Soul scene as DJs and dancers became big wheels in the Acid House scene later on. And there were tons of writers. You know, they did that the way the English do. They were very scholarly and very passionate. So people like David Godin of Blues and Soul magazine and David Nathan, another major music writer, they championed her and told her tale so that when she finally gets to go to England in the late 90s, she's met at the, you know, people asking for her autograph on the tarmac. And she ends up working with this guy, Ian Levine, who is a big player in techno roll. He's a big part of the Northern Soul story and then a big part of the high energy story, which High Energy was kind of the post-disco dance music that came out of San Francisco, London, and New York and was devastated by AIDS. A big, very gay music scene. And Ian Levine was a DJ at Heaven, the big, big London gay disco. And he decided he's going to resurrect Motown Records, had inherited some money, comes to Detroit in the late 80s, founds Motor City Records and says, I'm going to pick up where Barry closed down the party. Well, I'm starting it up all over again. And as Betty said, he gathered up the leftovers. I mean, everybody, Marv Johnson, Kim Weston, Dennis Edwards, Eddie Kendricks, Bobby Taylor, Brenda Holloway, the Contours, the Four Tops, the Marvelettes, the Velvets, the Supremes, minus Diana Ross. And because Betty had done an album and Ian loved her, he included her, and she bitches that several of the Motown people said she shouldn't have been there. And I'd like to know who the Motown singer, what she describes as the morbidly obese Motown singer who overweight crackhead is actually what she called the woman, who got physically stuck between two buildings because she went in that little alley to buy some crack.
Yeah, I don't know who it was, but I would be willing to bet that there's no loss between that person and Betty.
no love loss there. And look, you know, if you listen to those records, Levine basically did high energy backing. She called them modern disco beats, but it was more that 80s style that became, you know, the pop style of Britain in the mid and late 80s. Those albums didn't go anywhere, but Ian paid everybody. And that did help build her in England. She, you know, did the Northern Soul Weekender in Cleethorpes, UK. I can only imagine how badly I'm mispronouncing that. That's in northeast England. But yeah, fans were on the tarmac waiting for her. And she also talks about the deaths of David Ruffin and Eddie Kendricks from crack. And those she wasn't laughing about. She was crying about that. She knew those guys, you know, David Ruffin in particular, she knew from the get. And one of the great lost, and he achieved so much with the Temptations, lead vocals to the Temptations in their peak era, but then he, you know, never became Marvin Gaye or Stevie Wonder, died quite young in the 90s. You know, but she's sticking it out. She's working in local politics. She's active in the H. Ross Perot campaign. She's hosting local cable shows. She, you know, keeps it together. She's got a strong family. That's another thing that helped her survive this, was there was always mama to go back to and sisters and others. And then, you know, once again, gets this call out of the blue from Randall Grass of Shanachie. Do you know how to say that one? Shanachie?
That's us trying it.
Yeah, so apologies, probably a Native American word maybe, but anyway, he calls her up and says, I can't sign you, but I love you, and he promises to get her a booking agency, a record deal, or a gig, and manages to do it. He ends up introducing her to Dennis Walker, who was hot at the time from being Robert Cray's co-writer and producer. And they finally make, I guess she'd made one album already on Motown, but they make A Woman Like Me, which again, the record label dies before the thing comes out. And Dennis Walker, whom she left her longtime love for, gets busted in some kind of drugs nonsense and is headed down the river. And so it came out, I guess, a year too late. And it was her final work with Rudy Robinson. I found that kind of poignant that Rudy passes away right before the Golden Age starts.
Yeah, he kind of sends her off, which is it's sad, but it's also beautiful at the same time. That album, A Woman Like Me, which the book is named after, it's a really, really strong album, and it's very much steeped in, like, I guess, what the blues scene, because I think Etta James talked about this in her autobiography, how so much is encapsulated these days by the blue, by this term, the blues. But I think it is really emblematic of what the blues scene has been, maybe since, you know, Malico came along, and since, you know, Dennis Walker was doing his thing with Robert Cray. And I think it's among the best examples of that sound. She considers it R&B, which I would probably agree with.
I think that's very accurate. I mean, this is a scene where, like, you know, Austin, Texas's own Fabulous Thunderbirds were always marketed as this blues revival band. But I knew about Stax because of the Blues Brothers. And as soon as I saw him, I was like, these guys are trying to be Stax, you know?
Yeah.
And which to me isn't the blues, it's soul, but that's, you know, hair splitting, whatever. There was this scene and they took Betty in. And yeah, it's a strong album. I'm very allergic to that production style. So it really, I had to get over that.
And I understand.
give that album several listens. But yeah, it's strong stuff. And it set her up for this run that is so unlikely, but it's time to cue. We're going to go back to the disco era. And here's Betty doing The Best That I Can, remixed by Walter Gibbons. That was Doing the Best That I Can by Betty LeVette from the late 70s on West End Records, which, like I said, she walked away from right away. And I kind of think if Betty had stayed there and been a mid-level disco queen, she would not have become the Betty LeVette that she became.
No. I feel like she had to get to this place. I think the opportunities that we're about to talk about created the Betty LeVette that everybody knows today. You know, well, clearly everything did, but there are lots of these disco queens that are out there, and, you know, God bless them, but there's a ton of them. Chic, just one band, just like ran through singers.
Yeah.
So that could have been Betty, but Betty just even if she got bad breaks, when her big break finally came along, it fit her really well.
Yeah. Yeah. It worked for her. And you know, the guy from Shinichi Records managed to hook her up with another dude, Mike Kappas of the Rosebud Agency. Dennis Walker was involved in that connection too. And Kappas was somebody who was like, look, I love your stuff. I love your work, but you don't have a big management team. You know, this is a big agency. We just can't do it. I'm so sorry. Then she gets a lucky break and she gets to sing for a birthday party for a Mill Valley that's north of San Francisco for a record store owner. And Kappas sees her live, and that changed his mind. And from there on, she's golden. Like, Rosebud is a serious agency. Betty can deliver the goods because, like I said, she has stayed in shape. She has stayed in voice, and she has grown as an artist and is constantly growing as an artist. And they can easily put her to work. And now she's working constantly and doing the major festivals on these blues bills with like Etta James and Bobby Bland. Now, Bobby Bland is also kind of a weird variant of blues. He's that Memphis blues style, came up with B.B. King. And Johnny Ace, the late great Johnny Ace, and so the Memphis style blues from that era is a little different from the Chicago style blues, much more connected to what was going on in the R&B scene at the time. And and then she gets another angel. This guy Frederick Wilhelms III is this lawyer who volunteers and tracks down her old royalties, which I imagine took some doing, you know. And maybe he even got some royalties out of Atlantic. You know, by that time, Jerry Wexler was no longer on the scene, and you're just dealing with the Warner Brothers, you know, bureaucracy. It might have been Time Warner by that point. And, you know, so money coming from the past, money coming from live gigs. And then she gets this opportunity with Anti. And I'd never heard of this label before reading the book. And now, where's the dude's name? Andrew Culkin is the head of it. And there's some other records. You know, she talked to Ry Cooter for a while, but he was super expensive and nobody wanted to put that kind of money into her. But Anti's one of these independent labels that had figured out how to make it work around the turn of the millennium. And he's thinking big. He's thinking albums. He's thinking conceptually. And that leads to her probably, I mean, it's hard to say, but her most well-received work, and it's high-quality work. I've got My Own Hell to Raise, produced by Joe Henry, and then The Scene of the Crime, co-produced and backed by the Drive-By Truckers, which, not a combination I saw coming, but when you think about it, you know, Patterson's Hood's dad, David, right, was the Swampers. And so, you know, very, you know, perfect fit. And the first album, the concept was songs by women. Betty didn't like that idea, but they persisted. And because her husband, Kevin, was just this natural amateur A&R man who, you know, picked most of the tracks, she felt like she had done R&B. She had made her R&B statement on the previous album. And so they're doing a lot of country stuff and a lot of folky stuff. Joan Armatrading, Amy Mann, Sinead O'Connor. I thought that was, you know, mixed with some Dolly Parton, Bobby Kreiner, gets to play David Letterman. You know, she's getting the W.C. Handy Award. Things are good for Betty. I really enjoyed this part of the book.
Yeah, so did I. I do think, those lost recordings that she made in, you know,
yeah, we got to mention that too. That was a big part of it. Yeah, the Souvenirs came out, which was the Child of the 70s album, which was believed to have been burned up in a fire.
Yeah.
And Betty found a copy of it in her attic and played it for some people, and including, I got a book coming notes, but a French record label put that album out as Souvenirs, and she ended up having a live album come out in Europe in that same year. And that was a key part of her comeback. She did a Let Me Down Easy in concert, her first live album. That was on Munich Records, came out in 2000. And then Art and Soul Records was what put out Souvenirs. And yeah, a guy named, and I apologize, I'm sure I'm mispronouncing this, but Guy Pitard, that can't be the pronunciation of that, but so my apologies. But he, you know, he tracked down the master tape in the Atlanta archives and is able to put it out. And that started getting her in magazines, and that set her up, you know, for more stuff. And the way she met her husband, the guy caught, what did he email her? Emailed her out of the blue, cold email.
Yeah, this is like
with John Tiffin.
Yeah, this is maybe the first time that the internet plays a role in success anyway. But you know, there is so that Northern Soul scene really blossomed. And like the internet was, it just became very early on the place for music heads.
Yeah.
And there's lots of soul websites that are still around today. I wish I could, like, Soul Walking is one of them, but there's a bunch of them that are really crucial in holding up to the light. Lots of these folks like Betty LeVette, who were and are still out there doing it. But I wanted to say that those albums that didn't come out in the 70s that are those classic 60s, 70s sounding things that would have come out in Atlantic, things that were recorded Muscle Shoals and things like that, those are great. And they very much get you to understand, okay, this is how you can see her as right along there with an Aretha Franklin or you know, even a Tina Turner or somebody like that. However, these albums that she put out in the early part of the millennium are so unique. Aretha is not putting out "I've Got My Own Hell to Raise." She's just not. She's not gonna cover Lucinda Williams and Fiona Apple for someone like Betty to do that and do that in just as good of a voice, if not better than she had ever been. And combine it with this really gritty sound that Joe Henry had found, that then the Drive-By Truckers had found, is really quite remarkable. And she had already displayed really great talent for interpreting all kinds of songs, particularly, you know, songs written by, you know, these rock and roll guys like Heart of Gold, Neil Young. Also in Child of the 70s is It Ain't Easy, David Bowie. But she comes back to doing that again on I've Got My Own Hell to Raise. And you listen to a song like Joy, and it's hard to even remember that Lucinda Williams ever did that song. It sounds like a Betty LeVette song.
Yes, she took a while. I don't think that was a David Bowie song. That was the Three Dog Night is who that was.
I could have swore it was. I thought it was.
David Bowie has a song called "It Ain't Easy," but that's not it. And that, I only knew that because it came out a couple years later. I don't think so, because I just Googled it. It's the Three Dog Night in 1970. But maybe
check it out. I think it's from Ziggy Stardust.
No, there is a song called "It's Not Easy" on Ziggy Stardust, but it's not "It Ain't Easy." That's on Three Dog Night's first album, March 31st, 1970.
Okay. So, yeah. Written by Ron Davies. Us internet music heads.
yeah, you gotta, you know, because people will be calling me. But we gotta tell the story of the Kennedy Center.
Yeah.
So her husband got word. Oh, Steph tells me we got a cue, and this is a great song. This is the revenge happy ending song. This is Before the Money Came In, the Battle of Betty LeVette. This is Betty with the Drive-By Truckers.
Back in 62, before you were born, and your mama too, I knew David Ruff when he was over, sleeping on my floor before we crossed over. All my friends on the Grammy show, I was stuck in Detroit trying to open doors. Record deals kept falling apart.
And that was Before the Money Came, the Battle of Betty LeVette with the Drive-By Truckers, co-written by Patton Hood. And yeah, the story Betty LeVette, she tells her own story brilliantly, powerfully. These are really good albums. I'm usually very snobbish about, I only want the prime work, I only want the vintage production styles. And this stuff, there was a lot of cool stuff going on in the 2000s. It was a time when you could, you know, the internet's gobbling up the music industry, but if you were going for that sweet spot, critical respect, moderate sales, good live touring, you could make a good living and do some really quality stuff that really built your audience. But this Kennedy Center deal, her husband gets word that George Jones, the great country singer, is going to get get an award at the Kennedy Center. And he's pushing for Betty to get to sing a George Jones song. But of course, everybody wants to sing a George Jones song. And so the people there, though, they love her version of Little Sparrow by Dolly Parton, but they don't have anybody to sing a Who song. And because the Who are going to get Kennedy Center Awards, which I don't quite understand. I mean, they're great work and everything, but I didn't know British people could get it. But anyway, Pete Townsend, Roger Daltrey are there. And she gets to sing Love Rain Over Me, which is the perfect pick from the Who's discography. That's one of those. That's like when Metallica had to cover Queen had to cover an electro artist and couldn't figure out who and settle on Queen finally.
Stone Cold Crazy, yeah.
Yep, Stone Cold Crazy. And, you know, Love Rain Over Me is the perfect one. And Aretha Franklin's there. Barbara Streisand's there. Beyonce's there. Pete Townsend cries while she's singing. It's a really powerful video to watch. He's sitting right next to Barbara Streisand, I think. I didn't see Aretha in the footage, but she was there. Betty knew it. And Roger Daltrey comes and kneels before her like she's a queen backstage after that performance. And Betty said, "This is as close to heaven as I'll come." And then she gets to sing at the Obama inaugural with Jon Bon Jovi.
Yeah, that's our times.
that really sums up the Obama era, doesn't it? But let's not let that take off Betty's shine, because that was a glorious moment in our country and our culture.
No,
maybe
no.
it was a delusional thing, but people loved Obama. I loved Obama. We were so excited, and
it was monumental.
Yeah, you know, Betty's right in the thick of it, getting her just rewards at last. So it's, you know, and if you look at her discography, I've only spent a little bit of time tracking down those old singles, which thanks to the internet, it's remarkably easy. But between all the stuff she recorded in the 60s that was released and unreleased and on the itty bitty labels, the stuff she did in the late 60s and early 70s on Atlantic and Epic, then the disco song. It would have been interesting if she'd done a whole disco album, but she did do that whole Motown album in the Rick James era. And then this late run, you know, everything from 2000 on, pretty much, it's she's got a body of work that compares with her contemporaries. I mean, I think the gods have said, Betty, you are the equal of, I'm not going to put it up there with Etta and Aretha, but right.
Well,
I mean, she could hang with them on any given night, I'm sure, but.
I think the thing is that she is so herself, just like those two. She especially now is so unique in, her voice and in her phrasing, and unlike them, she's doing the most unique work of her career, like right now. And you know, I've got my own hell to raise, and the scene of the crime are great. But then, you know, she has continued to put out albums like Worthy is a really good one. There's another one that is all Dylan covers.
Yep.
And she really owns this stuff.
Yes.
I think it's really, really cool that in an era when she wasn't the only soul singer that was, you know, spent, you know, a long time not having the light shone on her as much, and then getting to the spotlight in the 2000s. There was a whole soul revival that to some extent is still going on. And I guess like Amy Winehouse was like emblematic of that. But you know, Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings were going on, and Lee Fields and Charles Bradley, and all that stuff was really cool, and I really love all that stuff. But what she was putting out, and you know, she's sort of a part of the same sort of reclamation project Betty was, but with her reclamation project, the music is unique, and you wouldn't have heard anything like that back in the 60s or 70s. Nothing against, you know, any of that other stuff that was and is coming out now.
And I think the key is this Jim Lewis influence that he taught her to immerse herself in an older tradition, which was the old interpretive singer tradition that we think of with Ella Fitzgerald and Frank Sinatra, and that whole school of thought where a great singer can sing anything and make it their own. And that's something that I think a lot of her contemporaries, that was not something that was part of the 60s soul tradition. I mean, obviously they interpreted songs, but this idea of the interpretive singer as the star, you know, they would, you know, somebody like Etta or like when Aretha Franklin covers Otis Redding, she just owns Respect. Yeah. She doesn't necessarily, that was just this unique collision. So it could be really challenging to find material for somebody like Etta or Aretha. And I think it's why they didn't have, you know, a Sarah Vaughan style late career or whatever, but Betty did. And I think it's because she was ready for that. She was raised in that interpretive school. And yeah, the Amy Winehouse angle, I hadn't thought of it. Yeah, you had them all over the place, Nora Jones. And I mean, just that was very much an era that appreciated this. It's kind of like the analogous to the blues revival in the 60s. And yeah, she's kind of like the Mississippi John Hurt or whatever, you know, unearthed in Avalon, Mississippi by some blues heads, you know. And I think it was Slim House that had to be taught how to play his songs again. But Betty was not like that. She had stayed focused and was ready to go. And she seized her opportunity and had a happy ending, which is this the first in our series?
Well, I think, you know, I think the Aretha one's a happy ending. I mean, Etta James staying alive was a happy ending.
Smokey had a happy ending.
And certainly Jerry Wexler had a happy ending.
Yes. Well, we don't know what happened to Jerry after he passed. True. But now I'm not going to judge Jerry Wexler. But I would love to know if he was the one who pulled the trap door out from under her, because it would be just like him to remember that sassy punk girl that walked away from Atlantic at, she was 17 or 18 at the time. You know, I could easily see Wexler pulling the trapdoor on that, but I could also easily see it just happening through corporate indifference and some bean counter down in the basement saying, you guys are, although Atlantic at that time, they weren't bean counting. I mean, you know, I did a whole show on Warner Brothers in that era, and they had their latitude. So anyhow,
it's hard to say.
Yeah, it's hard to say, but it's been a treat, Brooks. The book is Betty LeVette, A Woman Like Me, co-written by David Ritz. And Brooks and I are going to continue our David Ritz book club with the Neville brothers next time.
Yeah, looking forward to that.
Indeed.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's fantasypoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. Fantasypoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.